Well, these were interesting results indeed. But was Young's idea only good for explaining the case of light coming through two slits? In fact, during the second decade of the century, his theory received new support. A French savant named Augustin Fresnel did what the French were noted for. He provided a mathematical treatment of Young's waves that was very suggestive. Light, as you know, bends around corners. You've seen that when light from one room comes through a door into another one, bends around the edge a little. Well, Fresnel's mathematical analysis of this phenomenon predicted that if you put a small disk in the path of a beam of light, the light would bend around the edges of the disk and converge toward the center to produce a bright spot in the middle of the shadowed region. And when the experiment was done in 1818, that's exactly what was observed. So Young's understanding of light as a wave continued to gain ground. In fact, light would be regarded as waves in the ether for the remainder of the century. But it was in the middle of the century when something unexpected happened concerning light. And it involved one of those Scotsmen we met in Lecture 22 when we were discussing the kinetic theory of gases. I'm talking about James Clerk Maxwell. Maxwell discovered something new about light when he wasn't even trying to. He wasn't working on light. But an unexpected result popped up. What was he working on? He was trying to decipher why electricity and magnetism were related, as Oersted, Ampere, and Faraday had found them to be. They had all uncovered different aspects of the way electricity and magnetism interacted, even to the extent that people had started to build electric generators and motors. But the British scientists were not yet willing to buy into Ampere's explanation of electrodynamics as the last word on why electricity and magnetism behaved as they did. We met the basics of electromagnetism back in Lecture 26. Recall what Oersted discovered, that a current-carrying wire deflected a magnetic compass in its vicinity with a force that seemed to act in a circle around the wire. Ampere, who described the forces involved mathematically, came to the conclusion that just as static electrical charge exerted force, moving electricity could exert force too. So in his view, magnetism was just electricity in motion. But the non-mathematical Faraday took a simpler, more intuitive approach to the subject. He visualized curved lines of magnetic force acting around a wire. He then found a way to produce electrical current by cutting magnetic lines of force. Scientists like Faraday figured out how to manipulate the intimate relationship between electrical and magnetic force to get one from the other. So there existed these competing approaches to the understanding of electromagnetism. And we should also mention as well Oersted's own grand philosophical explanation of it, based on the unity of nature, of nature's forces. At mid-century, there was no consensus yet that scientists had come to agreement about why the relationship between electricity and magnetism existed. Then in 1860, Maxwell approached the question by trying to conceive of a mechanical model that related electrical and magnetic force. He visualized the relationship between electrical and magnetic force in a current-carrying wire as a mechanical interaction between parts of an ethereal substance. I told you we'd come back to the ether again. Here's what he did. He postulated that the ether penetrated into the wire and that there were rotating vortices or eddies in this ether. And then he imagined that these vortices were separated by tiny spheres rotating in the opposite direction to act as ball bearings between the vortices. French hated this kind of thinking. It reminded them of an English factory with wheels and pulleys and ball bearings. To them, it was too dependent on imagined entities. But it was the way the intuitive British mind worked, in this case, Maxwell's. Now, Maxwell let these circular acting magnetic forces be represented by the rotating vortices of ether, while the electrical charges were represented by the little ball bearings. And now came the payoff. Since the system was interlocked, if you rotated motion in the ball bearings, it made the vortices turn. Likewise, if you turned the vortices, the little ball bearings had to turn. Electricity and magnetism had to occur together.